As we enter into the process of the meditation and the initial orientation towards just settling, connecting and grounding our attention in the immediate experience, as we start to settle, we can bring in, as I suggested for the sitting just now, just the capacity to begin to identify particular elements or aspects of the experience, to pick out the ending of the in-breath, the ending of the out-breath. It's a very useful practice to engage in, to notice things ending. And this is a way we can engage in the practice in support of exploring the theme and the reality of change, of impermanence. This is a fundamental aspect of the Buddha's teaching, the Dharma, that things change. And the Buddha described it as the elephant's footprint. I find that a rather lovely image or metaphor, not necessarily what we use as an idea, maybe that commonly in our culture, but the elephant's footprint is the footprint which encompasses all other footprints. It's the biggest one, in simple terms. And in the same way, the Buddha spoke about the truth of impermanence as that truth which encompasses all other truths about this world. All that arises is subject to passing. This reality, this truth, dominates the world of things. And it's really something that serves us to give attention to this. It's not a surprise to any of us. We know about it at one level, and yet at another level, we do not necessarily really fully take it in and take it on as to what that means. We could say this human existence is like living in rental accommodation. And we just think about what that might mean. Quite some years ago now, my wife Catherine and I returned to live in the UK after some time at a retreat centre in America. And we didn't have many resources, and so our options for where we might live were relatively limited. And we were very grateful and felt very fortunate to be invited to come and live at a rather nice, you know, I guess say, and large, stately home, and perform the not entirely needed function of being there in case the elderly gentleman who'd lived there needed help. And he didn't really want anyone there, but his family felt better if someone was. And so we were given a whole wing of the building to live in, and it was rather lovely. Some of you may know the Sharpham Estate if you've been to Totnes, and the grounds there and on the River Dart, beautiful. And so we were living there and without paying rent and really minimal requirement. I think I drove him once to the doctor and once to get his car washed at a car wash. Catherine, my wife, she did flowers for him sort of most weekends, but it wasn't too onerous as a deal, really, for getting, you know, a whole place to live in. And they were very very gracious with our being there. And then at one point, somewhere along the line, about a year later, they invited us in, the family, and said, actually, you know, we'd like you to move out. And of course, well, we can't really argue, can we? It's not like we've got a contract here. So sure, okay. And we were homeless for a while. We were moving amongst friends' places and short-term accommodation. And then some friends of ours we knew from travels in India were buying a home. And they were in a fortunate situation to be able to buy quite a large home. And they said, well, actually, you know, we don't want to live in this large place all by ourselves. Why don't you come and join us? And we thought, great, sure. So we lived at a well below market rent in this rather lovely place with these nice folk, and you know, living together has its ups and downs, but it seemed to be going reasonably well. At some point about 18 months after we moved in, one of our regular weekend or sort of monthly sort of community meetings we had, you can see maybe where this is going, they said, well, you know, it's been a good experience, but we'd like it if you could actually move out. And okay, so it's kind of like, we could take this personally, but I think it's more just in the nature of things that we see, and this was a very particular experience of this situation of being invited in, offered something wonderful, and at some point being told, actually, it finishes now. Not when we decided, but when they decided on both occasions. And in some ways, our experience as a human being of finding ourselves arriving into this life, into this mind, body, heart, this thinking, feeling, breathing experience we call being alive, it's kind of like that. It's like this is temporary accommodation. We get to be here for a while. The landlord or landlady is kind of unpredictable. We don't know when we're going to be told, actually, it's time to move out now. We might not get a lot of notice. And to really get that that is so for us, not just in the absolute sense of course, yeah, one day we have to move out of this body entirely, this mind entirely, it would seem. But even just the ongoing process of being invited to leave the body that I used to have, which was more comfortable or more capable or more healthy or more strong, and without, you know, being moved into downgraded accommodation, where actually there's a lot more that needs fixing. And the tradespeople seem to have less clue about how to fix it. And it's like, oh, that's actually been going on a while. We've probably noticed that in some way. And this is going on all the time and in relationship to everything. This is something the Buddha invited us to contemplate, to reflect upon, to look at, not just through our mind where we go, yeah, I know it's like that, but actually to really feel and be to allow ourselves to be sensitive to be conscious of, and to be impacted by that truth. That everything which is mine, beloved and dear to me, that I will one day be parted from. Everything that is mine, beloved and dear to me, that I will one day be parted from. And what is it to just acknowledge that for ourselves? Our circumstances will change. Ultimately, they will cease, or we will. Those that we're fond of will die, and so will we. And we know this, of course. It may be appropriate that there's some sorrow, sadness, or grief that arises in relationship to our experience of it that's already happened in our lives and that we can see as part of what we'll be up to. It's not inappropriate to have a feeling response to this. But for most of us, the kind of feeling responses that arise that are might occasionally be the sense of relief, oh, phew, it doesn't go on forever, but often it is more like, oh, I'd quite like it if the bits that I liked could continue, and the people I liked could continue, and the functionality that I quite enjoyed could continue. Yeah, I'd quite like that. That because it's actually kind of tender for us to acknowledge that process of loss, of change, and there's sorrow, sadness, grief that might arise. And we don't really fully advert to the fact. We don't fully take it in and let ourselves be touched by it in such a way that it's only if it's actually kind of happening right now. We go, oh yeah, it's happening. And then we kind of fade away into a semi-sleepy sort of, yeah, I know, but I don't want to pay attention to that. And this is something that doesn't ultimately serve us. And the Buddha himself in his journey was very deeply impacted by, affected and struck by his encounter with impermanence, with the fact of human frailty as a fundamental reality. The encounter, it's described and, you know, well known for those who've sort of, you know, had some contact with these teachings, the contact with someone who's elderly, someone who's sick, someone who's dead, as a kind of a, oh my gosh, yes, this happens to us. This happens to us. What's the implication for my life? The Buddha's journey in search of what might be most significant, meaningful, fundamental in life was was stimulated to a significant degree by the question that arose from him in the contemplating and the engaging and the being impacted by this. He said, you know, seeing things around me and myself being subject to impermanence. And he spoke about it in very particular ways, you know, subject to birth, aging, sickness, death. Being myself subject to this, does it make sense for me to spend my life pursuing other things which are also subject to this? Why should I, who am subject to birth, aging, sickness, death, chase after things which are also subject to birth, aging, sickness, death? Would it not make more sense that being myself subject to this, I might seek for, to understand, to discover, to realize what is not subject to that? Now, this is the question he asked himself as he left his life, that led him to leave the life, the comfortable life in the palace, the beautiful wife, lovely son, and the privileges and comforts he experienced. And it's not that it's saying we have to somehow abandon all things we find around us that are nice, but to see this, the living in the, oh, it's not really going to happen, or at least not for a long time, that's kind of where we live in our palace of relative comfort, of not fully taking on the implications of, actually, for any one of us, today or tomorrow, something can be gone. A person, a functionality of our body, it happens like that. Something precious to us. I spent the last week trying to get my running shoes back. Someone I know at a place we were staying together walked off in them thinking they were his. And when he worked out they weren't, he left them somewhere else, having not realized where he started, where he first put them on. And of course, I didn't find them because they weren't there. And just even my running shoes, like these things help me take care of my physical well-being. And without them, I'll injure myself if I run. And I noticed how much I was attached to these things. I got them back just before I left for here. So I was fortunate and happy to go for a run this morning. But I was also just reflecting on, gosh, it's just that quick, isn't it? Just one, and this is just a pair of shoes, my gosh. But in terms of my well-being, it makes a difference to get exercise. And just, oh wow, these things can go so quickly. Things that we have, and just even small things. We all know, of course. And we will have known the loss of things larger than that. People, places, relationships, jobs, homes. Not always by our choice. Most often not by our choice. So it's all around us. We know it goes on. Nobody is going to, you know, even a five-year-old child, if you ask them, does everything always stay the same? Do things continue forever? They're probably going to say no. You know, they got some idea about it pretty. Maybe it takes till 7 years. I don't know exactly. But it's early on. We get the idea. And yet, the key question, this is always the issue with teachings of wisdom, is not do we know what they say, but do we live in accordance with them? Wisdom is only liberating, is only conducive to our well-being so far as we live in accordance with it. That's its value. And so, you know, it's amazing if we examine our life, our experience, to what extent we do or don't live in that way. And I often reflect on this experience. It's happened to me in many different ways, many different forms that I've had this particular experience. But one that stands out to me is a time when I was about to go and teach a retreat at Gaia House for a week. And I was going to be staying there for the week. And so I was needing to pack clothes to take. We've been having a really sunny week. It's, you know, it was rather fortunate and lovely for about a week. It was in June, I believe. It had been sunny and warm. This is going back quite a few years. It doesn't happen so often. But I found myself sort of puzzling and pondering as I was looking into my wardrobe and looking out at the sunny weather, thinking, actually, I don't really have many sort of tidy clothes for warm weather because I don't spend much time in it. I've been living in England probably 10 years by then. You know, there's a few T-shirts and things, but not much of the sort of, you know, it's not like I need to dress up formally, but I want something that's reasonably tidy when I'm doing what I do. And I was kind of getting a little bit tangled up, and I said, oh gosh, I just don't, what am I going to do? I'm going to not have the right clothes. And in the end, I packed all I could pack, and I went to the retreat, and, you know, I guess a day or two into this week-long retreat that I was teaching, the weather changed. And it got cold, it got wet, and I went back into my suitcase, and I looked, and, you know, I haven't even brought a jumper. And I was thinking, what was I thinking? What had happened to me in that moment, in that process of somehow having gone through a whole week of sunny weather, having assumed the next week would be sunny too, and sweated, worried, been distressed about my lack of preparedness for another week of sunshine, and failed to bring a warm sweater, jumper, jersey. Sorry, it's jumper here, isn't it? These words, wherever I am, they have a different word for that. But I grew up with a jersey in New Zealand. Someone here might relate to that. But over here, it's a jumper. And if we reflect on how that happens, we see, we so quickly slip into that mode of assuming continuity. It's something to really notice, to really look for in the mind. The tendency to notice, or the tendency to assume continuity, the fundamental, not the, but a fundamental misperception we operate under, to see that which is impermanent as if it was permanent. That which is subject to change as if it was not. How many times in our meditation do we experience something arising we find enjoyable, pleasant, flattering perhaps? We call it good meditation. Mind is quiet, body is calm. Things seem like they're going somewhere, you know, we're... And before we know it, we just have this thought, oh gosh, you know, this is rather good. Maybe I'll give up my job, say goodbye to my family, put on some robes, go to the cave, I'll, you know. And before we know it, there's this whole image arising of this wonderful meditation career, and perhaps there's a, you know, crowd of people outside the cave as we're meditating, and they're bathing in the glow of the light that's, you know, pouring out from the entrance to the cave. And then at some point, of course, we click, oh my gosh, I just projected into the future this fantasy based on an idea of what would happen if this rather calm, clear, present experience happening right here and now were to continue. Because it's pretty good and I like it, and actually it's better than most of the other things, so why wouldn't we imagine in that way? But of course, having seen it, in the next moment it's like, oh my gosh, there was I deluding myself that I was a skillful meditator. I was actually lost in a fantasy, in a whole self-inflation indulgence. I'm hopeless. I've been doing this for years, and look at me, I can't do it. I might as well give up. I'm going to go home right now. Heck with staying even a whole day here. And again, we flip into the other of now getting lost becomes my permanent version of the experience, which I then extrapolate into a whole identity and life. And we do it so quickly. So quickly. You know, something arises that's not comfortable for us, and it's not comfortable, but we're okay with it. You know, it's interesting. We sort of wonder, can I be with this experience? The truth is, we're already being with it, because it's here and we're here. We're already being with it. The can I be with it, or I don't think I can be with it, is not the it that's happening now, but the projection of, I can't be with it if it continues for how long and gets worse. But already in that, we're in relationship to something that's not happening. And we can't, it's true, we can't be with that. It doesn't exist. The pain I'm going to be feeling 5 minutes from now doesn't exist. We get lost very quickly in our attempt to handle that which can't be handled, not because we have no capacity to handle it if it was happening, but because we can't handle something that isn't happening, but we've believed is. So we do this all the time, and it's really useful to start to watch the language we articulate our experience to ourselves or to others in. Anytime we find the language saying, it's always, or it's never, we're assuming a solidity and continuity of experience that it doesn't have. Even when we say it's the same as, and assume that this moment of confusion is just the same and part of the larger experience of confusion I had, or oh, I'm kind of feeling a bit sort of miserable. No, it's the same misery I had the other week. I've been miserable for 2 weeks now. Actually, there was probably 12 days in between this misery and the last misery that were fine. But we just link them together, tie them up, and make them solid, as if it continued in that way. And that sense of continuity is so much what makes it hard for us to actually allow the way things are to be as they are. We get casual, you know. Oh yeah, it's nice, I'm here for a day of practice. I've got the whole day. Actually, we don't know that we have the whole day. I don't want to concern anyone. But every day, people get a phone call. Or maybe we've turned our phone off, so we won't. I hope you've turned your phone off. But maybe something happens to the building. It's not earthquake country in this part of the world, it seems. So probably we're safe from that one. But who knows what will happen? But just bringing in that, it offers an edge of immediacy, a slight frisson of, oh, actually, if we really recognize that things are not guaranteed to continue the way they are, we're much more likely to pay real attention to what's happening here. We only fall asleep to our experience because of the assumption that it's going to be pretty much the same over the next period of time. Now, at some level, that might be true. But if, you know, we happen to know that at some point today, the floor was going to become liquid. Over a course of about 5 minutes, it would change from being solid to liquid. We'd kind of probably be checking every now and then, just see, is it getting soft? No, it's all right, we're fine. But the idea of kind of going to sleep for half an hour wouldn't be a great idea, really, would it? We'd think, oh no, I want to just keep checking, because at the point it starts getting liquid, I think I'll move. Of course, we might move a bit before then. So there's a quality of urgency that arises from recognizing the truth of impermanence, the reality of change. It brings us alive. So much of why we live unconsciously is because we're living out of a belief of continuity. If that is taken away, unconsciousness makes no sense to us. We might know it doesn't make a lot of sense up here, but in terms of how much time we spend in it, it's because at some level we're subscribing still to the idea that things will continue. At least for a while, or mostly as they are, when there is no guarantee of this. And so the question, you know, how am I spending my time? As the Zen reflection goes, you know, these days are relentlessly passing. How well am I spending my time? What am I giving my life to? Because it isn't forever. Again, we know that. I'm not telling you something you don't know. But do we know that in each moment, in each time, we're making a decision, we're making a choice with what we do with our life, what we do with our resources? And time and life is primary resource, but we have other resources too. If I knew this wasn't forever. The French philosopher, Guyot, he once said, if we know but we do not act accordingly, then we know imperfectly. If we know but we do not act accordingly, then we know imperfectly. So our knowing hasn't actually completed. It's not full knowing. It's not a real knowing. What we really know, we live from. What we don't live from, we don't really know. And yet the idea, the conceptual knowledge, often we hold that and it kind of stops us approaching the deeper knowing of something that we have a conceptual knowledge of. And the process of deepening insight that is one of the fundamental elements of the practice of meditation as the Buddha taught it and as we've been engaging in it here together, is the transforming of our unconsciously held and enacted misperceptions. Insight is the transforming of our unconsciously held and acted on misperceptions. And also the process in which we are able to see, affirm, and support our capacity to act from that which is a correct or accurate perception of how things are. And beginning to discern, because we have both of these, beginning to discern which is which. So a movement from blindness to wisdom. Blindness being the condition in which we don't see the truth in this realm of reflection. We don't see the truth of change, of impermanence, in the places where it would serve us if we saw it. It's not that we have to put a big sort of change, sort of impermanence sign in front of us and only look at it. That's not the only lens which it may serve us to look into the world through. But it is a lens that is essential, crucial, and profoundly helpful in many situations. Misperception, it's really important to understand, is not because we're stupid. You know, the original translations of the Buddha's language translated avidya as ignorance, which in our culture mostly means stupid, you know, ignorant. It's blindness. Not seeing is perhaps the most literal way we could understand the word. Not seeing. And not seeing arises, misperception arises, that particular blindness arises because we haven't examined our experience carefully enough. We haven't seen it directly, precisely, and in a sufficiently sustained way to take on what it is revealing to us again and again and again, moment by moment. So there's an image I have that I find useful for this, that's helpful to explain how that is, because it's a little curious really, isn't it? How can it be that I get it, and I see it, and I know it, and yet at some level it's clear to me that I don't? I mean, it's particularly ironic for me, who spends quite a bit of my time talking about this, to that experience with the suitcase and the lack of a warm thing, you know, and the whole... It's like, wow, it happened so powerfully. How does that happen? How does that happen? Well, I don't think it's so mysterious, actually, when we examine it, when we look at it carefully. And I'd like to give you an image that you might find helps make it clear. Imagine you're driving in a car on a straight road, a long straight road. And so you're looking out the front of the window, windscreen, at whatever's in front of you. And if you look at the horizon, what you'll notice is, perhaps this, you've had this experience, you notice that whatever's on the horizon in front of you, some distance ahead, even though you're traveling along at, you know, 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, it's not really changing. Although you're actually moving towards it really quite quickly, it's not changing. It's just that. Now, if you would look out the rear window at what's behind you on a long straight road as you're driving along at 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, it also isn't changing. Don't do that while you're driving, obviously. But as a passenger, you can do this. You can look. You can see. Huh. What happens if you look out the side window at what's immediately adjacent to your vehicle as you're driving along at 50, even 30, but certainly at 50 and definitely at 70 miles an hour? What happens if you look straight out there? Again, don't do it while you're driving. It's going past so quickly you can't actually focus on anything. It's a blur. You cannot see the stones, you cannot even see the sort of the marker posts sometimes. They're just flickering, boom, 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 as you go past them. If there's a row of trees, it's just a blur. And that experience is precisely what it's like for us when we're oriented, as we often are unconsciously, to the future and the past. Most of our experience, when we're not present, we're orienting towards the future, what's in front of me, and it's a fixed picture of what I think is coming. And it's fixed precisely because it's based on an image from the past, which is not an articulation or a recollection of the past. It's a very discrete and finite and limited number of fragments of the past which we've pasted into a picture and called the past, my rememberedness of the past. Now, it's only a fragment because in order to re-experience the past fully, it would take as long as it took to experience it at the time. We couldn't do it. I can't remember my last 30 years because it would take me 30 years to do it. Or my last 50 years, or my last 10 years, or my last week. It would take me a whole week. What I remember in a moment is just a fragment. But we believe that we're remembering what it was and as it was. And it tends to be a fixed picture. We know it's not actually how it was, because if you get five people in a room who were there at the same time and say, what happened? You get five very different and sometimes remarkably contradictory versions of what happened. We know that up here. But in here, no, I know what happened. My version of it is what happened. But what we do is we take this fragment, constructed image, fragmentary or partial image of the past, we place it in front of us. When we look forward, it's not changing. When we look backwards, it's not changing. Unless we do some work on our minds. And then we start to realize, oh, it's actually, it is changing. But in the normal mode, it's fixed in the past, it's fixed in the future. And so far as we're fixed on that, we're looking into the past to figure out how to deal with the future. That's the basic unconscious orientation is, in what happened then, I'll find the answers to how to repeat what was good then and avoid what was bad from then. It's the basic orientation. If I can figure out how it was that the bad things happen, I'll make sure they never happen again. If I can figure out how the good things happen, I'll make sure I repeat them. And in that, we're transfixed between past and future. In practicing mindfulness and practicing insight meditation, we start to look at the immediacy of rights here. And if we look at the point, like looking out of the car, straight out the window at the side of the road, it's flickering. It's moving so quickly. It's so fast. And we need to actually start to slow it down a little bit to take that in. You want to see what's happening on the side of the road? That car needs to get down to 5 or 10 miles an hour, maybe 15. And then we can see, oh, okay, that's what's happening. This is where I actually am. The apparent solidity of our experience and our sense of who we are bound up with the tendency to place our attention in the past and the future. When we place it in the present and as and to the degree we can do so, and we learn, we train our ability to do so, we see that the experience is fluid, not solid. It's fluid. This mind, body, heart experience is constantly morphing, changing, shifting. And the experiences of our life that we've had, they're gone. They're not to be found, the thoughts that we've had, all of them so important. The body that we had, it's gone. And what will come, the thoughts that are not yet happened, they're not waiting for us in a cupboard. The body that we'll have in 5 or 10 years if we're here still, or 20, it's not there somewhere waiting for us. It doesn't exist. There's no existence. But there is this. The experiences keep dissolving if we examine them. They keep dissolving. But there's this. This encounter, this meeting, this ability to know, be present, be mindful, be awake in the midst of this. It's kind of unsettling for us. It's not so easy to be in this condition. What we notice is that there's a tendency to seek security, to seek some kind of solidity, to fix it, to be in a condition in which things are fluid is, first of all, not to be able to take the snooze that we'd like to take with much of our life, sort of be asleep. It's not available anymore. It's not available in the animal kingdom. Most animals, you look at them, you see, at least animals in the wild. I don't know if that goes for domestic animals, like sheep and cows, but certainly wild creatures, if you look at them, they're present, they're awake. Even when they're relaxed, they're there. They don't go asleep in it, and you can tell because the moment something happens that they need to be alert to, they're fully present. If you watch them. And we, however, human beings, we find it rather unsettling, I think, to really sit in the presence of this truth. And so the tendency is to kind of try and create security through the ideas and the images and the external structures that we invest in. Things, people, relationships, being right. And a hope for something that will ward off the reality of change. It doesn't work, does it? We know that. It's not that we can't build things, create things, develop things with people and places and understanding and material and all these things that we have the fortunate privilege to be able to work with in our lives. But ultimately, all of them fall apart. So how do we live with that reality? So the image I find also compelling in this territory, I find helpful to reflect upon. It's like children making a sandcastle. We've probably done it ourselves, some adults making a sandcastle. Where do you make a sandcastle? Have you thought about this? Do you think it would make sense to try and make a sandcastle below the low tide zone? I've never seen anyone try. It makes no sense. It's covered in water all the time. If you try to make a sandcastle above the high tide zone, it's just dry sand. It doesn't do anything. You can't make a sandcastle there. The only place you'll ever make a sandcastle is between the high tide and the low tide zone. It's obvious. We don't have to think about that. But if we reflect upon, you're building these things in an environment in which the tide is going to come in. And of course, children or adults making sandcastles might despair and scream and say, no, 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 and try and stop the water. Or they might dance and cheer as the waves roll in and jump in and, you know, kick the turrets over themselves. And one might imagine that the second approach is perhaps slightly more in line with what's happening. But ultimately, equally, one can just see what happens, huh? Yeah, we can't stop it. Whatever we create, by the nature of being creatable, it's in the tidal zone. It's in the tidal zone. By being constructible, it's also destructible. And so how do we then live our life? And I'd offer as a response to that the words of Helen Keller, who lived a remarkable life despite being both blind and deaf. And she once observed, she said, it's a rather well-known quote, I think, she said, "Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, and nor do the children of mankind as a whole experience it." In the long run, avoiding danger is no safer than outright exposure. Life is either a glorious adventure or it is nothing. Life is either a glorious adventure or it is nothing. Remarkable words. It's a remarkable woman. You're just taking a moment to notice how this lands for you. And without judging at all, however, if you notice that your mind tends to bat it away like, I know, just notice that. Be aware of how we do that. I know. I mean, I know. I've been talking about it for years. But I also don't know. Be interested in the ways we don't know. Because that's where we can wake up. So let's just sit for a moment quietly.